Support for the Splendid Table podcast provided by the Muir Glen Organic Soup Collection. Gourmet recipe soups made from premium garden fresh ingredients. Online at muirglen.com.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today we talk hospitality with Danny Meyer. He runs 11 eateries in New York City, and his skill in pleasing people is nearly legend. Danny's book is Setting the Table, The Transforming Power of Hospitality in Business. Improvisational cook Sally Schneider steps us through ad-libbing with those audacious root vegetables. We meet the man who tasted shapes. The term Indian corn has new meaning when a long-lost little ear finally comes home to its native tribe. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 118 years. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, I have an assignment for you. For all of us who have decided we are not baking this Thanksgiving, we are buying pie, I want to know, what are your favorite picks for great pies?
What a wonderful assignment. Thank you very much, Lynn. Let's start in the middle of the country, in Maquonago, Wisconsin, at a farm stand called The Elegant Farmer. And when I say farm stand, I'm really kind of minimizing it. It's a great big farm stand. But they are most famous there for apple pie baked in a paper bag. And exactly why the paper bag creates such terrific pies, I don't know. I'll leave that up to the scientists. But let me tell you that the crust on this apple pie is, it's crunchy and sugary, almost like a cookie. The bottom is flake tender. The filling between the crusts is soft and just al dente enough, gently seasoned, just right sweet. This is the apple pie of my dreams.
And the only thing better than that apple pie is their version that has caramel in the apple filling. So you get this great crust, and then you get a layer of melted caramel, and then you get the crunchy apples.
And they're putting this all in a paper bag?
Yeah.
It bakes in a paper bag, and then you cut open the paper bag, and there is this gorgeous, gorgeous pie inside of it.
Oh, that sounds like a great thing to bring to the
table. And
they
do that. You can get it by mail, so you can actually, you know, wherever you live, you can order one.
You can?
Yes.
Wow. I'm so glad you guys.
I had no idea.
It's good that you're on the same page.
I didn't know this because when I need an apple pie and I'm at home, I go to Shelton, Connecticut, which is not far from where Jane and I live. I go to Beardsley's Cider Mill. It's a great place because it really is a cider mill. They have a room next to where the pies bake where you can watch apples being turned into cider. And the aroma in the cider room is intoxicating. I mean, the aroma of apples. And then you go into the pie baking room, and that's intoxicating in a whole different way because, you know, the smell of an apple pie baking is devastating.
Yeah. And you mix that with the cider thing, and you've got to have,
And if you do want to bake a really exotic apple pie, Beardsley specializes in what they call ugly apples. These are kind of rare, you know, heirloom varieties that we've never heard of. I mean, the Kingston Black, the Tremlett's Bitter, the Brown Snout, the Spitzenberg, these are all varieties of apple you can get at Beardsley.
That's fascinating.
I know.
I wonder if there's a correlation there. Great cider apples make great pie. All right, we need one more pie place.
Okay.
Where have we not? We have not been to the West End.
What about Olali Berry Pie?
Olali Berry Pie, yes. And the place to get that is Duarte's Tavern in Pescadero, California. This is a stage stop that has been around for well over a century, and it's been well known for a long time since we started traveling for its Olali Berry Pie. Have you ever had one of those, Lynn?
What in heaven's name is an Olali Berry?
Well, it's kind of, if you look at it, it looks like a somewhat fatter blackberry. It's got the million little kind of nodule type things on it. Mm-hmm. And what's great about it is that in a pie, or at least in the kind of pie that they make at Duarte's, it's really tart. I mean, it's sweet, no question about it, but it's got a real powerful, fruity tartness about it that no other fruit that I know has. So it's a really bright flavored pie.
Even though it's a berry, it's got that, sort of strawberry rhubarb sense to it where it's sweet and tart at the same time.
I love that in a fruit pie.
Me too.
Oh, it's the best. And of course, with ice cream on top, it's even better.
And this part of the country is the artichoke capital of the United States. So you kind of have to have artichoke soup or artichoke something first and then just, put your snout into an olali berry pie.
And if you insert a turkey in the middle, you've got Thanksgiving dinner.
There you go.
Hey, guys, thank you and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving,
happy Thanksgiving, Lynn. Have a great holiday.
Thanks.
Are you going on Thanksgiving Day to those family celebrations, passing on knowledge down through the years at the gathering of generations? Every year it's the same routine, all over, come on over, it's Thanksgiving Day.
Gene and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. The website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our free e-newsletters. We have got two for you now, the Classic Weeknight Kitchen and, for a limited time, Baker's Chronicle. It's a weekly e-newsletter devoted to bakers and baker wannabes. Every week you get a new recipe, and this week, by the way, both newsletters have bonus recipes for the holidays. And as usual, they're free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Where some of us look for rigid rules in cooking, cookbook author Sally Schneider gives us the rules, but then shows us how to riff on them. One recipe becomes many opportunities. Sally's new book is The Improvisational Cook. Sally, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. Good to be here.
Okay, girl. What are you going to do for us for Thanksgiving? We need sides here.
We do. We need sides, and we also need fun. And I find that Thanksgiving can get very uptight. We're supposed to do the beloved recipe of somebody who was around 1,000 years ago. And so I want to include a model for a side dish.
So it's sort of a formula that we can apply.
Exactly. Thank you. And it's basically a braise done in a skillet on the stovetop. Very easy. It's modeled after a classic Provençal potato dish, which is of potatoes braised in white wine with shallots and olive oil. Now, that being said, the basic formula can accommodate a great deal. I encourage you to do it with root vegetables and or potatoes. That means parsnips, parsley root, celery root, turnips, anything you find in the market that catches your fancy. The other couple of essential categories of ingredients are a flavorful liquid, which could be white wine, cider, broth, even water. Mm-hmm. And you can add flavorings that will, as they're heated, will give their flavor to the water. So that's all you need, curry powder or herbs or whatever. And fat is a key. This means butter, olive oil, brown butter, a nut oil, bacon fat. All these ingredients are just combined in a skillet and simmered. So it's unbelievably easy. And as the liquid evaporates, the vegetables become infused with flavor and glazed with the fat. It's just wonderful. What's beautiful about it, Lynn, is you can use any combinations of vegetables. The only thing I recommend is that with stronger ones like turnips and rutabagas, you pair them with the sweet ones like parsnips or potatoes, which will kind of mellow them.
Can you give me some specific ideas?
I'll give you some of my favorites. I particularly love half parsnip and half parsley root. That's the root from the parsley plant, which has a kind of spicy flavor that's just wonderful. And I do that with white wine and rosemary and olive oil. Potatoes are wonderful in lemon juice and water with some thyme. And again, olive oil is the fat. They become like my grandmother's lemon potatoes, which she used to roast alongside every roasted meat or whatever.
I never think of lemon and potatoes.
It's unbelievable. They become kind of tart and saturated with the perfume of the lemon. And yet they're glazed with the oil so that they're very mellow.
Mm.
The other day I did celery root, fennel, and onions, which are the classic combination which go with an Italian roast pork. So I just did the vegetables and did a really simple pork roast and served them together. Now, just one more, which I think is interesting, which were parsnips, which I did in a kind of Asian way with toasted sesame oil, ginger, scallions, and then I threw some cilantro in at the end, and I served it with a roast duck.
Oh, that sounds
so
good.
So, you know, you get the idea. All of these things go wonderfully with Thanksgiving or just about any roast you have during the year. You can also throw some Parmesan or Gruyere on top and either bake it further or put it under the broiler to make a gratin, you know.
Right.
The dish itself makes a great simple supper with just some maybe shavings of goat cheese or whatever on it. But best of all, I love them the next day. They make terrific hash browns because there's a little residual fat, and you can brown them in a nonstick skillet or a well-seasoned cast iron skillet till they get crusty like hash browns. But they're made with root vegetables. This is particularly great if you use bacon or pancetta fat in them. And then, you know, you can throw a fried egg on them or alongside for a breakfast. Or shall I go one step further?
One.
You know, what to do with the turkey leftovers? Well, if you shred the turkey and mix it into any of the combinations of this dish that you might think to make, you're going to have a great turkey hash.
Well, down the tubes with Aunt Lucy's potato casserole.
Sorry.
This is great. No, this is great. And I love the idea of the hash. Hey, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider's new book is The Improvisational Cook. Now, we've got Sally's starter recipe for improvising side dishes. Find Roots with White Wine and Shallots on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the one great key to Thanksgiving, our all-time favorite interview, and Indian corn goes home after 200 years. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Thanksgiving's the opening fanfare of the entertaining season. Now, between now and January, we're going to be carving turkeys, swapping cookies, lighting candles, and generally being terribly social. 'Tis the season of hospitality.
And 'tis the season of white-knuckle panic for all control types and rookie hosts. Well, we have some help from a man who entertains guests every night in 11 eateries in New York City. He's got a jazz club, a burger joint, and he has the Union Square Cafe. In 20 years, restaurateur Danny Meyer has become synonymous with the word hospitality, and he's written a book, Setting the Table, The Transforming Power of Hospitality in Business. Danny, it's good to have you back with us.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You know, in the book, you differentiate between service and hospitality. What is the difference?
Service is a word that was really, really important in the 1980s and maybe even the 1990s. And all it describes is, did the right thing happen? So, for example, if it's a restaurant, was your reservation there on time? Mm-hmm. If it is, that's good service. If it's not, it's not. Hospitality is far more important in today in business altogether. And that is, how do you make people feel when you deliver that service? And I believe that whether people are entertaining at home or whether they're going out to eat in a restaurant or renting a car, long after they forget whether the stuffing is any good in your turkey, they're going to remember how you made them feel. And that's hospitality.
Is there a switch here in mindset? I've got to focus on what other people need, what my guests need, as opposed to my table is gorgeous, my food is perfect, I've done it all ahead, and now I want you to have a good time.
Absolutely. Nobody comes back for seconds at Thanksgiving time just because you got every recipe perfectly. They come back because it felt good. And it's just the way of life. And I could not believe this any more strongly. And it also makes me incredibly happy to know that this is probably the most effective business strategy on earth.
Danny, was there a moment or an experience when the idea of hospitality crystallized for you?
There were a lot, and I think back to Thanksgiving in my own family. We'd go down to my grandmother's house, near the Arch in St. Louis, mm-hmm. and, the food was great. She made incredible turkey. I remember I even liked the sweet potato thing with marshmallows, which I can't stand, but the reason I liked it was because it represented love. But here was the moment that sticks in my mind. It was the minute my family would get to my grandparents' apartment, I would be beckoned into the kitchen with all those amazing smells. And my grandmother and the woman who helped her cook knew how much I loved food, and they would let me have a preview of every single thing we were going to have all night.
Mm.
And I remember that a lot more than I even remember sitting down to the table. It was something that they were doing for me. They were on my side. It was thoughtful. It was happy. All the words that I associate with hospitality.
Is this something you can breed into your family? You have children. How old are they?
We have four children who are ages 7 through 13. And it all starts around the table.
Mm-hmm.
The table is the heart and soul of a family. It's, if you think about it, Lynn, the first four gifts any of us got within moments of being born were a smile, eye contact, a hug, and some pretty good food, maybe nature's most perfect food. And that's what people end up craving for the rest of their lives. It happens on an ongoing basis at home. Thanksgiving is the most symbolic, representative holiday we have in this country. It's loaded because if people don't get those four things, they don't really care about the turkey. So they're mm-hmm. just really coming back for those four things. And we know that in business as well. And can it be taught? Can it be bred? It's tough. When I hire people, I cannot teach people to have a high HQ or a high hospitality quotient. What I can do is train my staff to identify people who have those kind of emotional skills. And every time we find that, we sure do everything we can to hire them. Hospitality can be caught, but it's tough to be taught.
I'm curious, would you hire your own kids? Are they good hosts?
I would hire my own kids in a second if I wanted them to go into the restaurant business.
That's another question. But are they good hosts, do you think?
They're great hosts because they're curious, they're kind, they're optimistic. They need to work on their work ethic, but they're getting there. They're highly empathetic. It matters to them how other people feel. And they've got integrity. And I think that in the long run, that's the emotional skill set that leads somebody to be great at hospitality.
Danny, may it be a wonderful Thanksgiving, and thank you for joining us.
Well, I sure am appreciative for being welcome. Thanks, Lynn.
Restaurateur Danny Meyer has 11 restaurants in New York City, including the 20-year-old Union Square Cafe. His new book is Setting the Table, The Transforming Power of Hospitality in Business. Okay, so you make everybody feel warm and fuzzy around the table, but you still have to cook the blasted turkey. Well, this year I decided to clear the prejudices away and do some more turkey tests. Now, I'm a staunch believer in the low-temp, slow-roasting for the tenderest bird approach to cooking the turkey, and I want my stuffing inside my turkey. But this year I tested high heat and fast cooking and brining to see if quality held when you cut the cooking time. Now, for speed, you have got to give up the stuffing inside the bird. So I brined two 10-pound turkeys the exact same way, roasted one at 450 degrees at about 10 minutes to the pound, and the other one at 325 degrees at about 18 minutes to the pound. Well, I have to admit it. You can roast the Hades out of a turkey once it's brined. All that salt and liquid keeps the meat juicy. And my fast turkey's pretty darn good. So you can get the recipe, fast and crisp roast turkey scented with apples and basil, on the website, splendidtable.org. And there are more ideas for Thanksgiving there than you can shake the proverbial stick at. Splendidtable.org, guys. What you're about to hear could alter how you see your dinner mates on Thursday. You could have a synesthete in the crowd. In fact, it could be you. Synesthesia is a quirk of the human brain that links people's senses. For instance, you see colors when you hear music. Well, neurologist Dr. Richard Cytoic specializes in this area of research. Several years ago, when we discovered his book, The Man Who Tasted Shapes, we asked him to join us in the studio. And he remains for all of us one of our most intriguing guests and an ideal one for Thanksgiving. Now, doctor, what actually is synesthesia?
Well, you know the word anesthesia, meaning no sensation.
Yeah.
Synesthesia means joined sensations, wherein somebody is born with two, three, or all of their senses hooked together, such that my voice, for example, is not only something that they hear, but also something that they see or taste or touch. And we call them synesthetes.
Huh.
They are surprised to discover, as children, that the rest of the world is not like them.
Well, in the book, The Man Who Tasted Shapes, you worked with one particular subject named Michael.
Right.
Could you describe how Michael experienced food?
Well, Michael had a very unusual kind of synesthesia, which was a combination of taste and smell with touch. And he felt things in his face and hands. And he would say, with an intense flavor, a feeling sweeps down my arm into my hands, and I actually feel texture, weight, temperature, as if I'm holding something. And of course, he could see that there wasn't anything in his hand, but he says, nonetheless, it feels like I'm holding something.
I remember something about a chocolate mint pie had 12 columns.
Well, Michael would describe things very elaborately, but he was not being metaphoric, but just describing the sensation. So chocolate mint, for example, he said, I can reach out into the distance and stick my hand among what feels like a whole bunch of smooth glass columns. And I said, well, how do you know that they're glass columns? And he said, well, they're not really. He said, but I can reach out and I feel the curvature. And it's cool to the touch, so it's got to be stone or marble, but it's so deliciously smooth. I can run my hand up and down. I can't even feel where the top or the bottom end, so it's like a column, and it must be made of glass. So that's why it feels like cold glass columns.
He would be a wonderful food writer.
He was a great dinner companion, I'll tell you that. He was very entertaining.
Did he cook?
Oh, he cooked quite well. In fact, that's how we met. He was my new neighbor in North Carolina. He taught at the School of the Arts. He was a lighting designer. And he invited me to dinner. And he delayed our sitting down to table with the comment, oh, dear, there's not enough points on the chicken. Now, his friends laughed and said, oh, what are you smoking? But Michael turned to me, and he was beet red, and said, well, maybe you'll understand. You're a neurologist. I've had this thing all my life where I taste according to touch, and I wanted the chicken to be a pointed, prickly shape. It's come out all round. I can't serve this. And I said, oh, you have synesthesia. And to which Michael said, oh, my God, you mean there's a name for this? So he thought he was the only person in the world. He thought this was a very private experience that nobody else could understand. And that's a very typical sentiment among synesthetes.
Doctor, could you perceive the differences in taste in, for instance, that chicken that Michael was perceiving?
Oh, no. To me, chicken is chicken. But Michael was disappointed because when he talked about he wanted it to be a pointed shape, he said, no, it needed to be a prickliness, as if you were laying your hand on a bed of nails. And so he cooked according to the shape of things, not according to any kind of recipe or starting with, oh, I want this to taste like thyme or garlic. He loved prickly pointed shapes. He loved round, smooth shapes. And so in the early experiments that we did with him, I started out with things that were completely sour to things that were completely sweet and then mixed them up in solution. So it was very hard to tell what was 50-50, what was 70-30.
Mm-hmm.
And he could discriminate extraordinarily well these nuances.
So were the sweets round and the sour things or the bitter things prickly?
Bitter was more of a smooth inclination.
How interesting.
Whereas the sweetness did tend to have round and columnar forms. That is mostly curved, and he could rub the curve. He used to love to rub textures. So if you know, we would eat a pâté or something, and he would pause for half a second and go, and then he would reach his hand out over the table, and you could see him moving his hand as if he were actually palpating the roughness or the smooth, oiled surface that he felt. And then he said, oh, this is so wonderful. But it only lasted, you know, a second or two and then faded away.
How exciting.
So in the visual, I often say that synesthesia is like fireworks in the sense that, you know, there's this explosion, something appears, it kaleidoscopes a little bit, and then a second or two later, it fades away. That's what synesthesia is like.
Huh. Are people with synesthesia essentially connecting sort of more of the dots than the rest of us? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, have they evolved further? Are their brains different?
Oh, their brains are definitely different, and you can prove that with paper and pencil tests as well as with very fancy million-dollar brain scans. They're not more evolved, but they're simply aware of an earlier process of evolution in which perhaps the senses were more less divided. It turns out that all of us are synesthetic, but we're not aware of it. So synesthetes have a conscious look at an earlier stage of any kind of perceptual process. All the senses sample the world, if only just a little.
Well, Doctor, thank you. And if you ever start working with a chef, will you promise you'll call us?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Richard Cytoic is the author of The Man Who Tasted Shapes. Boy, consider this fodder for conversation during those little strained moments with the beloved family. Indian corn for most of us is the big multicolored ears that are decorating everything in sight right now. But for the Northeast's Abenaki Indians, the corn of their ancestors was sweet, with a cob that was only 3 inches long. Well, some thought that the corn was lost over a century ago, but some Yankee seed savers have been growing it. Reporter Tatiana Schreiber sought out these two corn keepers.
For 33 years, sheep farmers Sarah and Charlie Colley have been tending a small patch of what they called Indian corn, saving a few cobs each year to replant. For 25 of those years, the patch has been here in their meadow garden, high above the lazy oxbow region of the Connecticut River in Newberry, Vermont.
Two rows of 10 or 12 feet long.
Wow, so that's not really very much.
No, it isn't. No.
Wow. You never had a crop failure and lost the two rows?
Never.
You know, it survives the worst droughts, and in a summer like this one where it rained all the time, the corn loved it. Oh. It was the best year we ever had.
It was just these traits, the corn's hardiness and frost tolerance, that endeared it to a man named Carol Green, who the Colleys met in the 1970s.
He was a character and a half.
Vermont, New Hampshire, old style, self-reliant, cantankerous at times, persistent, a little stubborn.
Those are good characteristics for a seed saver, and Green had been saving the corn seed his entire adult life.
He told us how his family was from Newbury, Vermont, and that he was a direct descendant of the early settlers of Newbury, and the Abnaki Indians befriended his ancestors back in the 1760s. The Abnakis gave his ancestors the corn, and then his family passed the seed down, and Carol ended up with it in 1973 and gave us some.
The corn grew only about 3 or 4 feet tall and matured a month earlier than most sweet corn.
It's like discovering a dinosaur egg, you know, and having it hatch. These little ears of corn were so different from what we were used to.
Over the years, the Collies carefully stewarded the unusual corn and tried to interest others in growing it, too. But no one really wanted to take it on. Not until this year, that is, when they happened to meet Nancy Lyons, chief of the Koasuk Band of the Abenaki Nation.
I said to her, "We've been keeping your corn," and she almost fell down on the ground. She was just flabbergasted. It was just a wonderful coincidence.
Not long after that, Lyons sent an email to her friend, Fred Wiseman, who directs the Abenaki Museum in Swanton, Vermont. Wiseman is Abenaki himself. He's also a paleoethnobotanist who studies the interaction of indigenous peoples and their environment over time. When he heard that someone in the Upper Connecticut River Valley had been growing a small sweet corn with 8 rows of kernels, he thought there was a good chance it was the same or closely related to a type his own ancestors had grown.
I'm intrigued by it culturally, kind of personally from my own heritage. I'm intrigued by it as an ethnobiologist, and I'm intrigued by it as an advocate for Abenaki sovereignty and Abenaki cultural revitalization.
Wiseman says it will take genetic testing to determine the exact ancestry of the corn, but he knows the Abenakis were growing something much like it almost 1,000 years ago at a site by the river called Skitchewog. Archaeologist David Skenes took me to the site, where he says excavations revealed evidence of wigwam floors.
Within these wigwam floors, we were finding storage pits that were later used as refuse pits. And a couple of these pits were the charred remains of corn, bean, and squash. And those remains were radiocarbon dated to AD 1120, thus making Skitchewog site the earliest agricultural site in northern New England.
I showed Skenes one cob of the Collie's corn. This is what it looked like. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really short.
I would certainly expect that this is from the same strain or a similar strain that had been grown here, you know, 900 years ago.
The Connecticut River was an important transportation corridor for the Abenaki, and there were many temporary and more permanent villages along its banks. Even today, the wide curving oxbows of the Newbury area provide flat river bottom land that's perfect for growing corn.
And the corn is going to be planted at the end of the field right there.
The Koasuk Band will plant their new old corn here next spring on land owned by a young Abenaki man who just recently became an official member of the band.
I can't wait to look out the window every day at my house and see that I'm bringing back the Abenaki culture, and it's right in my front yard. And that's where it'll be, hopefully, for generations to come.
The Abenaki received state recognition this past May after a long struggle in Vermont. Now, a bit of an Indian renaissance is underway, with new bands forming and children learning the Abenaki language. Fred Wiseman sees this rediscovered corn as part of it.
You know, it was down to just this one field, maybe. And now we're hopefully going to have it in a whole bunch of fields. And who knows, you know, 10 or 15 years from now, we'll have this huge harvest supper with 5 different varieties of indigenous Abenaki corn, 6 varieties of beans, 10 varieties of squash, with everybody, all the Abenakis from all over the place. I don't know, it's all a dream, it's all possible.
When not producing radio pieces, Tatiana Schreiber teaches environmental studies and grows organic vegetables in Westminster, West Vermont. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, this year's Thanksgiving question is, what is the merry thought? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, this year's Thanksgiving question is, what is the Mary Thought? Well, it's the wishbone. Mary Thought is the name that that forked bone had in England and America until around 1900. Now, the thing about the Mary Thought was that the custom was a little different from ours. Two people pulled the bone apart, and the one with the longest piece would marry first. Wishbone came into the picture around 1900. You just had to make a wish. There was no lifetime commitment required. Now, the official scientific name of the wishbone is the furcula. Now, we know it better for what it became on our dinner tables. It's the origin of the word fork.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me. Don't be afraid.
It's time for your calls, brought to you by Muir Glen Organic Soups, created to savor. Well, pick up that phone. The number's 800-537-5252. Let's see, we have got Susan on the line from Cincinnati. Hey, Susan, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have had this amazingly vivid childhood memory, naturally evolving around food and the holidays. And I was about 6 years old. I can just transport myself back to the exact moment when I was called downstairs to the dinner table, and kind of sparkling in the glow of candlelight, there were these crystal-cut candy dishes and everything on the table. But the most amazing sight, at every place setting, my mother had placed a small little jewel of a sparkling pear, a red pear. And in the center, in contrast, was this white, creamy substance, which I, as I got older, learned was cream cheese.
Yeah.
And these little red spicy pears and the cream cheese were sitting on a bed of lettuce on a coffee cup saucer, I guess,
at each play setting.
As I got older, she would have me help at Christmas time, and I loved working with her up through teenage years before I got married and moved away. I glanced at the jar. It was a glass jar, as I recall, and it said spiced Kefir, conifer. I thought there was K-N-E-I-F. I couldn't even remember the spelling.
Yeah, but it rings a bell to me, too. Kefir or something like that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so I looked for them. I tried cinnamon spice, apple rings as a replacement. No go.
Yeah.
But these pears were just tiny and wonderful and spicy, and they had a little bit of a grit to them. I remember tasting them. And I'd love to find them again or make them or recreate them. I have no idea whether they still exist or what.
I'm almost wondering if kefir isn't the name of the pear.
Mm.
But the thing is, you want a small, flavorful pear.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't find the little ones, you know, you could take any modest-sized pear.
Okay.
And what you would want to do is to have it, core it, peel it, and then what you want to do is sprinkle it with lemon juice.
Okay.
Meanwhile, you want to take sugar. I'm just going to do this off the top of my head, but you can look up in a good, you know, book on preserving and pickling. You'll find a similar blend. This would be the basic idea. Let's say you would have 3 cups of sugar to perhaps 1 cup or a half cup of white vinegar. Okay.
Okay.
I would use those cinnamon hot shot candies.
Okay.
You know, I mean, don't you think? I mean, it would add, you could crush them and then they'll melt into the blend.
It has the cinnamon, it has the color, it has the flavor.
Exactly.
A little sweetness.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the other thing I would put in there would be lightly crushed whole allspice, which you can buy in any supermarket. And you just, you know, you put it in a small bowl and with the bottom of your knife, you just crush it.
Okay.
A little. I would put in the cinnamon, and I would put in maybe a couple of slices of fresh ginger root, which you can find anywhere. And I'd put in a dash of salt.
And what I would do then is I'd bring that to a simmer and I'd let that boil for about 5 or 10 minutes, partially covered so that everything gets melted and you've got all those delicious flavors. I'd let it cool a little bit and I'd taste it. And if you think it needs more spice, you'd add more spice.
Okay.
Meanwhile, your pears are ready to roll. And what you would do is you could strain that liquid so you don't get any bits and pieces on the pear.
Yeah.
But what you want to do is gently poach the pears in that liquid.
Okay.
And they should be slightly underripe. You don't want them to be super ripe because they'll mush on you.
Okay.
So you want to maybe simmer them for 5 minutes and with a knife gently test them. You don't want them falling apart. You want them a little tender.
Okay.
And then leave them overnight or even for 2 days in that liquid in the refrigerator and see if it comes close to what you're talking about. Because what the whole key here is you want an intensely spiced sweet syrup with a bit of tartness to it.
Okay.
That's what you're looking for.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the pears cook in 5 minutes at most 10. Undercook them, but let them cool in the liquid and let them sit in it, and they'll be permeated completely with it.
Yeah. Well, there was such a festive touch to the table, and my mother was such a wonderful, still is a wonderful cook, and how she turned a modest holiday table into such a gem with these pears and the little cream cheese. It's always been in my memory, and I can't wait to try your idea and make it again.
She sounds pretty remarkable.
She is.
It'd be wonderful for you to make it for her.
I know. I love to try it.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you so much. I love your program.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
Okay. Happy holidays.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This idea of spicing fruit in this way and cooking it in a sort of sweet sour syrup, you can do that with almost anything. And you can even do it with things like sweet squash. And you just want to cook it through, but keep it a teeny bit on the firm side and then let it sit in that in the refrigerator. So it could be apples, it could be pears, it could be underripe mangoes. You pick the fruit. You could do it. And it's really a fabulous way to have sort of a side dish to use it on sandwiches. But it's really beautiful on a plate. Maybe turkey on one side and the fruit on the other. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who is up? Ah, we've got Phil calling from Ann Arbor. Hey, Phil, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hi, Lynn. About 37 years ago, I was diagnosed with food allergies. And I was told to stay away from fish, seafood, nuts, peanuts, sesame, you name it, I couldn't eat it. So for 30, 35 years, whatever, I avoided it like the plague. I couldn't eat out because people, you know, served that stuff in the restaurant.
Right, right.
It really affected my life. And then just sort of recently, I had a medical episode where the doctor thought it might have been an allergy. So he sent me to another allergist who retested me. And, of course, the allergist took a really good history on me and then did the test on everything and comes back and says, you know all that stuff you said you're allergic to? You're not allergic to it. So
okay.
All of a sudden, I can eat this stuff, but my question to you is, if you met somebody who hadn't touched seafood or anything like that for upwards of 35 years, and now you do know one of those people, what would you suggest that they go for to start off, something that really knocked their socks off?
Well, what I'm going to suggest, oh boy, I'll tell you what immediately comes to mind, but it may turn you off a little.
You never can tell.
Lobster.
Lobster.
Because, first of all, it is never going to be better than it is right now. Autumn into winter, into like December, is prime lobster season. And in fact, right now, you know, it's not the Christmas time yet when the prices go through the roof. Not that lobster is ever cheap, but it's for the quality, the price is going to be pretty reasonable. And to me, personally, there is no form of fish that is more luxurious and more luscious. And I like it just steamed, which means, you know, about 3 inches of water in a large pot. As I said, this is a little extreme.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to go in there. And when it turns pink, I just let it go another 5 minutes and it cooks in the steam and whatever and melted butter. And that's it. Now, that said, and my mouth is watering at the thought, I think it might be smart for you to maybe start out with something that is a little tamer than that.
Okay.
And I'm thinking of something, though, that's really special. And it's in good shape now. It's another shellfish, and it's sweet and it's succulent, and that's scallops. I think scallops they're in good shape at this point. You could do the little bay scallops or the big sea scallops. okay? And they, you could do something exquisitely simple with them. You could do a slow sauté in a little blend of butter and olive oil with chopped shallots and perhaps some fresh basil. Okay, that's it. And you cook them until they're just barely firm, all right? And you serve that with a squeeze of luscious lemon. And that, I mean, it would be the softest, most gentle, most pure, most utterly succulent way for you to gradually ease into all the treats you've been missing. And it's just, you know, it's utter simplicity. It takes 5 minutes to make. Does that sound like some stuff you might want to try?
Well, the fact is I haven't tried it yet, so I won't know until I do.
I think these are gentle flavors. These are agreeable flavors. These are all fish that in and for themselves, you know, completely simply are wonderful, but they're robust enough that they can take whatever playing around you want to do later. But if I would love to introduce you to seafood in its purest, very best, most wonderful form.
Okay.
Yeah. But enjoy. A whole world's opened up for you.
Thank you very much.
Hey, Phil, you take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Just remember that lobster information because it is prime time for lobster. And there's a wonderful cookbook came out about 5 years ago called just simply Lobster by Jasper White. He's a New England chef. He's probably cooked more lobsters in his lifetime than any other 10 people on earth. And the book has information, wonderful recipes, very simple. And if you're going to spend the money, you know, for me, steam melted butter. That's it. Okay, let's see. Who have we got? We have got Dan on the line. He's calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Dan, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hi, Lynn. I'm calling from West Michigan, and this is the heart of Michigan apple country. And I figured, what better way to celebrate fall than with an apple party?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to start out. We've got an orchard about 2 hours away that has 200 varieties of apples.
Holy cow, 200 varieties?
It's amazing. They've got a bunch of heirloom apples, and I'm going to pick up about 10 different varieties and start there, and then beyond there.
And then do another party next week and do 10 more and 10
exactly.
more and 10 more. Yeah, exactly.
But it's also going to be a hard cider tasting.
Ooh.
And I've found about 17 different varieties in town, including a homebrew I did last year. We'll see how that one does in the rain.
Is it been buried or is it sitting in the cellar?
It is in the cellar right now. Going to pop it in the fridge in a little bit. It's pretty tasty. But, you know, the rest of the menu is going to be everything apple. I'm going to, you know, desserts are easy. I'm going to make mom's apple pie. It's the best in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And apple tart. And I'm going to make a, you know, for the main dishes, it's going to be a pulled pork barbecue sandwich. I've tested it out. I kind of smoke it with apple wood. Is there any other choice? And then I missed it with apple cider during the cooking, and then, of course, an apple cider barbecue sauce. But the challenge for me is coming up with some savory dishes that use apple.
Oh, well, a piece of cake. This is the deal, okay? First of all, you're going to find a great chunk of cheddar.
Okay.
And since you're living in Michigan, I have a feeling cheddar is not going to be a hard thing to find. You've got great cheeses in Michigan.
Right.
And you're going to get a big hunk of cheddar. And what you're going to do is you're going to slice up those 10 different apples.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have slivers of the cheddar. And everybody's going to get a chance to taste naked apple and decide which ones they like best. And then they will have little sandwiches of apple slivers with cheddar around both sides of them.
Okay,
just get rid of the seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a little cocktail, whatever you want to call it, and that's one of the things that you nibble on with that hard cider.
Sounds perfect.
Now, the other thing you can do, I mean, again, it's all the apple and cheese is just one of the great naturals in the world. You've already come up with the pork, which is the other thing mm-hmm. I think is utterly dynamite with apple. But you know the other thing you could try is I'm thinking about taking chicken breast,
mm-hmm.
and if you marinate it in something that has oil, olive oil and apple is not necessarily the most traditional thing in the world, but I'm
right.
thinking of garlic, olive oil, rosemary, or sage, and apple. Fresh sage and apple would be fabulous.
Okay.
Marinate that, and then you could grill those pieces. They should be bite-sized pieces. You know, you take the boneless, skinless chicken breast, and you cut it in you know, half-inch, quarter-inch thick pieces across the grain.
Okay.
So that it's tender. And you marinate it overnight in that blend, and then you just do a light sauté, and you serve it at room temperature with toothpicks. And or you can just serve it with fresh apple chopped over the top of it. The other thing is you could grill it.
Now, what are the good apples for, like, if you were to saute something like that?
You want apples that keep their shape. So you want things like Honeycrisp. You want things like Greenings. You want Granny Smith. You want you want things like Northern Spies.
Northern Spy, okay.
Yeah, Prairie Spies. The Spy Family. The Spy Family are great for this.
All right.
Baldwins, Liberties. All of those are good crunch apples. And if they dissolve a bit, it's not the end of the world. You know, I mean, because you get this lovely stuff, you know, with it.
Absolutely.
You know that stuff, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think this sounds great. I love the idea of 17 hard ciders. Are they going to all sleep at your house?
Well, that's the thing. It better be a long party. And we've got some Calvados, too.
You are just going the whole route. This sounds like great fun. Now, you know what you should have for dessert?
Tell me.
You should have boiled down apple cider until it's an apple cider syrup.
Okay.
Okay, with the apple pie. But on the side, you should have my dynamite panna cotta, which is like vanilla ice cream, except you don't have to keep it frozen.
Oh.
And it's on the website, splendidtable.org. And it takes you 5 minutes to make, and you can make it 4 days ahead.
I'm headed there right now.
You got it. Have a fabulous time.
Hey, thanks so much. Thanks
you
for your help.
Take care, Dan. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And from all of us here at the Splendid Table to you and yours, may it be a fine Thanksgiving. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Oscar Wilde. He said, "Always forgive your enemies. Nothing annoys them more." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Additional support comes from A.G. Edwards & Sons, caring for nest eggs for more than 118 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. A.G. Edwards, fully invested in their clients. Everything you heard here today, solutions for life's little problems, and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletters. Weeknight Kitchen is our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek, and Baker's Chronicle will get you baking over the weekend. And you can also download our weekly podcast. Sign up for it all online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is supported by the Muir Glen Organic Soup Collection. Gourmet recipe soups made from premium garden fresh ingredients. You can learn more at muirglen.com. Muir Glen Organic Soups, created to savor. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Alexis Jonath. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Thanks for tuning in, and have a great Thanksgiving. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.